Interlude. Jean Tannen. 1. In the year that followed, Locke grew, but not as much as he would have liked. Although it was difficult to guess his true age with any hope of accuracy, it was obvious that he was more than a little runty for it. "You missed a few meals in your very early years," Chains told him. "You've done much better since you came here, to be sure, but I suspect you'll always be a bit on the medium side."
"Always?"
"Don't be too upset." Chains put his hands on his own round belly and chuckled. "A little man can slip out of a pinch that a greater man might find inescapable." There was further schooling. More sums, more history, more maps, more languages. Once Locke and the Sanzas had a firm grasp of conversational Vardran, Chains began having them instructed in the art of accents. A few hours each week were spent in the company of an old Vardran sailmender who would chide them for their fumble-mouthed mangling of the northern tongue while he drove his long, wicked needles through yard upon yard of folded canvas. They would chat about any subject on the old man's mind, and he would fastidiously correct every consonant that was too short and every vowel that was too long. He would also get steadily more red-faced and belligerent as each session went on, for Chains paid him in wine for his services. There were trials, some trivial and some quite harsh. Chains tested his boys constantly, almost ruthlessly. But when he was finished with each new conundrum, he always took them to the temple roof to explain what he'd wanted, what the hardship signified. His openness after the fact made his games easier to bear, and they had the added effect of uniting Locke, Carlo, and Galdo against the world around them. The more Chains tightened the screws, the closer the boys grew, the more smoothly they worked together, the less they had to say out loud to set a plan in motion. The coming of Jean Tannen changed all that. It was the month of Saris in the 77th year of Yono, the end of an unusually dry and cool autumn. Storms had lashed the Iron Sea but spared Camor by some trick of the winds or the gods, and the nights were finer than any in Locke's living memory. He was sitting the steps with Father Chains, flexing his fingers, eagerly awaiting the rise of false light, when he spotted the thief-maker walking across the square toward the house of Perelandro. 2 years had removed some of the dread Locke had once felt toward his former master, but there was no denying that the skinny old fellow retained a certain grotesque magnetism. The thief-maker's spindly fingers spread as he bowed from the waist, and his eyes lit up when they seized on Locke.
"My dear bedeviling little boy, what a pleasure it is to see you leading a productive life in the Order of Perelandro."
"He owes his success to your early discipline, of course." Chain's smile spread beneath his blindfold. "It's what helped to make him the resolute and morally upright youth he is today."
"Upright?"
The thief-maker squinted at Locke, feigning concentration.
"I'd be hard-pressed to say he's grown an inch. But no matter. I've brought you the boy we discussed, the one from the north corner. Step forward, Jean. You can't hide behind me any more than you could hide under a copper coin."
There was indeed a boy standing behind the thief-maker. When the old man shooed him out into plain view, Locke saw that he was about his own age, perhaps 10, and in every other respect his opposite. The new boy was fat, red-faced, shaped like a dirty pear with a greasy mop of black hair atop his head. His eyes were wide and shocked. He clenched and unclenched his soft hands nervously.
"Ah," said Chains. "Ah. I can't see him, but then the qualities the Lord of the Overlooked desires in his servants cannot be seen by any man. Are you penitent, my boy? Are you sincere? Are you as upright as those our charitable celestial master has already taken into his fold?"
He gave Locke a pat on the back, manacles and chains rattling. Locke, for his part, stared at the newcomer and said nothing.
"I hope so, sir,"
said Jean, in a voice that was soft and haunted.
"Well," said the thief-maker, "hope is what we all build lives for ourselves upon, is it not? The good Father Chains is your master now, boy. I leave you to his care."
"Not mine, but that of the higher power I serve," said Chains. "Oh, before you leave, I just happened to find this purse sitting on my temple steps earlier today." He held out a fat little leather bag stuffed with coins and waved it in the thief-maker's general direction. "Is it yours, by chance?"
"Why, so it is, so it is."
The thief-maker plucked the purse from Chain's hands and made it vanish into the pockets of his weather-eaten coat.
"What a fortunate coincidence that is."
He bowed once more, turned, and began to walk back in the direction of Shades Hill, whistling tunelessly. Chains arose, rubbed his legs, and clapped his hands. "Let us call an end to our public duties for the day. Jean, this is Locke Lamora, one of my initiates. Please help him carry this kettle into the sanctuary. Careful, it's heavy." The thin boy and the fat boy heaved the kettle up the steps and into the damp sanctuary. The eyeless priest groped along his chains, gathering the slack and dragging it with him until he was safely inside. Locke worked the wall mechanism to slide the temple doors shut, and Chains settled himself down in the middle of the sanctuary floor. "The kindly gentleman," said Chains, "who delivered you into my care, said that you could speak, read, and write in three languages."
"Yes, sir," said Jean, gazing around him in trepidation. "Therin, Vadran, and Isavrai."
"Very good. And you can do complex sums? Ledger balancing?"
"Yes."
"Excellent. Then you can help me count the day's takings. But first, come over here and give me your hand. That's it. Let us see if you have any of the gifts necessary to become an initiate of this temple, Jean Tannen."
What must I do?"
"Simply place your hands on my blindfold. No, stand easy. Close your eyes. Concentrate. Let whatever virtuous thoughts you have within you bubble to the surface."
2.
"I don't like him," said Locke. "I don't like him at all."
He and Chains were preparing the breakfast meal early the next morning. Locke was simmering up a soup from sliced onions and irregular little brown cubes of reduced beef stock, while Chains was attempting to crack the wax seal on a honey crock. His bare fingers and nails having failed, he was hacking at it with a stiletto and muttering to himself.
"Don't like him at all?"
"That's rather silly," said Chains, his voice distant, "since he's not yet been here a single day."
"He's fat. He's soft. He's not one of us."
"He most certainly is. We showed him the temple and the burrow. He took oath as my pezon. I'll go see the copper with him in just a day or two."
"I don't mean one of us, gentlemen bastards. I mean one of us, us. He's not a thief. He's a soft, fat..."
"Merchant. Son of merchant parents is what he is. But he's a thief now."
"He didn't steal things. He didn't charm or tease. He said he was in the hill for a few days before he got brought here. So he's not one of us."
"Locke."
Chains turned from the business of the honeycrock and stared down at him, frowning. "Jean Tannen is a thief because I'm going to train him as a thief. You do recall that's what I train here, thieves of a very particular sort. This hasn't slipped your mind?"
"But he's..."
"He's better learned than any of you. Scribes in a clean, smooth hand.
understands business, ledgers, money shifts, and a great many other things. Your former master knew I'd want him right away.
He's fat.
So am I. And you're ugly. Carlo and Galdo have noses like siege engines. Sabatha had spots breaking out last we saw her. Did you have a point?
He kept us up all night. He was crying, and he wouldn't shut up.
I'm sorry, said a soft voice from behind them. Locke and Chains turned, the latter much more slowly than the former. Jean Tannen was standing by the door to the sleeping quarters, red-eyed.
I didn't mean to. I couldn't help it.
Ha! Chains turned back to his stiletto and his honeycrock. Looks as though boys who live in glass burrows shouldn't speak so loudly of those in the next room.
Well, don't do it again, Jean, said Locke,
hopping down from the wooden step he still used to reach the top of the cooking hearth. He crossed to one of the spice cabinets and began shuffling jars, looking for something.
Shut up and let us sleep. Carlo and Galdo and I don't blubber.
I'm sorry, said Jean, sounding close to tears again. I'm sorry, it's just my mother, my father, I'm an orphan.
So what?
Locke took down a little glass bottle of pickled radishes, sealed with a stone stopper like an alchemical potion.
I'm an orphan. We're all orphans here. Whining won't make your family live again.
Locke turned and took two steps back toward the cooking hearth, so he didn't see Jean cross the space between them. He did feel Jean's arm wrap around his neck from behind. It might have been soft, but it was damned heavy for a 10-year-old. Locke lost his grip on the pickled radishes. Jean picked him off the ground by main force, whirled and heaved him. Locke's feet left the ground at the same time the radish jar shattered against it. A confused second later, the back of Locke's head bounced off the heavy witchwood dining table, and he fell to the ground, landing painfully on his rather bony posterior.
You shut up!
There was nothing subdued about Jean now. He was screaming, red-faced, with tears pouring out of his eyes.
You shut your filthy mouth! You never talk about my family!
Locke put up his hands and tried to stand up. One of Jean's fists grew in his field of vision until it seemed to blot out half the world. The blow folded him over like a bread pretzel. When he recovered something resembling his senses, he was hugging a table leg. The room was dancing a minuet around him. He said, his mouth full of blood and pain. Now, Jean, said Chains, pulling the heavy-set boy away from Locke, I think your message is rather thoroughly delivered.
Ugh, that really hurt, said Locke.
It's only fair. Chains released Jean, who balled his fists and stood glaring at Locke, shuddering. You really deserved it.
Huh, what?
Sure, we're all orphans here. My parents were long dead before you were even born. Your parents are years gone. Same for Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha. But Jean, said Chains, lost his only 5 nights ago.
Oh,
Locke sat up groaning.
I didn't know.
Well, then. Chains finally succeeded in prying open the honeycrock. The wax seals split with an audible crack. When you don't know everything you could know, it's a fine time to shut your fucking noisemaker and be polite.
It was a fire.
Jean took a few deep breaths, still staring at Locke.
They burned to death. The whole shop. Everything gone.
He turned and walked back to the sleeping quarters, head down, rubbing at his eyes. Chains turned his back on Locke and began stirring the honey, breaking up the little patches of crystallization. There was an echoing clang from the fall of the secret door that led down from the temple above. A moment later, Carlo and Galdo appeared in the kitchen, each twin dressed in his white initiate's robe, each one balancing a long, soft loaf of bread atop his head.
We have returned, said Carlo. With bread. Which is obvious. No, you're obvious.
The twins stopped short when they saw Locke pulling himself up by the edge of the table, lips swollen, blood trickling from the corners of his mouth.
What did we miss? Asked Galdo.
Boys, said Chains, I might have forgotten to tell you something when I introduced you to Jean and showed him around last night. Your old master from Shades Hill warned me that while Jean is mostly soft-spoken, the boy has one hell of a colourful temper.
Shaking his head, Chains stepped over to Locke and helped him stand upright.
When the world stops spinning, he said, don't forget that you've got broken glass and radishes to clean up, too.
3. Locke and Jean maintained a healthy distance from one another at the dinner table that night, saying nothing. Carlo and Galdo exchanged exasperated looks approximately several hundred times per minute, but made no attempts at conversation themselves. Preparations for the meal were conducted in near silence, with Chains apparently happy to oblige his sullen crew. Once Locke and Jean had seated themselves at the table, Chains set a carved ivory box down before each of them. The boxes were about a foot long and a foot wide, with hinged covers. Locke immediately recognized them as determiners' boxes, delicate Ferrari devices that used clockwork, sliding tiles, and rotating wooden knobs to enable a trained user to rapidly conduct certain mathematical operations. He'd been taught the basics of the device, but it had been months since he'd last used one.
Locke and Jean, said Father Chains, if you would be so kind. I have 995 Camori Solons, and I am taking ship for Tal Verar. I should very much like to have them converted to Solari when I arrive, the Solari currently being worth 4/5 of one Camori full crown. How many Solari will the changers owe me before their fee is deducted?
Jean immediately flipped open the lid on his box and set to work, fiddling knobs, flicking tiles, and sliding little wooden rods back and forth. Locke, flustered, followed suit. His own nervous fiddlings with the machine were nowhere near fast enough, for Jean shortly announced,
31 full Solari, with about 900ths of one left over.
He stuck out the tip of his tongue and calculated for a few more seconds.
4 silver Volani and 2 coppers.
Marvellous, said Chains. Jean, you can eat this evening. Locke, I'm afraid you're out of luck. Thank you for trying, nonetheless. You may spend dinner in your quarters, if you wish.
What?
Locke felt the blood rushing to his cheeks.
But that's not how it worked before. You always gave us individual problems, and I haven't used this box for...
Would you like another problem, then?
Yes.
Very well. Jean, would you indulge us by doing it as well? Now, a Gerishti galleon sails the Iron Sea, and her captain is quite the penitent fellow. Every hour on the hour he has a sailor throw a loaf of ship's biscuit into the sea as an offering to Yono. Each loaf weighs 14 ounces. The captain is a remarkably neat fellow as well. The captain keeps his biscuit in casks, a quarter ton apiece. He sails for 1 week even. How many casks does he open? And how much biscuit does the Lord of the Grasping Waters get?
Again the boys worked their boxes, and again Jean looked up while Locke, little beads of sweat clearly visible on his little forehead, was still working.
He only opens one cask, Jean said, and he uses 147 pounds of biscuit.
Father Chains clapped softly. Very good, Jean. You'll still be eating with us tonight. As for you, Locke, well, I shall call you when the clearing up needs to be done.
This is ridiculous, Locke huffed. He works the box better than I do. You set this up for me to lose.
Ridiculous, is it? You've been putting on airs recently, my dear boy.
You've reached that certain age where many boys seem to just sort of fold up their better judgment and set it aside for a few years. Hell, Sabatha's done it too. Part of the reason I sent her off to where she is at the moment. Anyhow, it seems to me that your nose is tilting a little high in the air for someone with a death mark around his throat. Locke's blush deepened. Jean snuck a furtive glance at him. Carlo and Galdo, who already knew about the shark's tooth, stared fixedly at their empty plates and glasses. The world is full of conundrums that will tax your skills. Do you presume that you will always get to choose the ones that best suit your strengths? If I wanted to send a boy to impersonate a money changer's apprentice, who do you think I'd give the job to if I had to choose between yourself and Jean? It's no choice at all.
I suppose.
You suppose too much. You deride your new brother because his figure aspires to the noble girth of my own. Chains rubbed his stomach and grinned mirthlessly. Didn't it ever occur to you that he fits in some places even better than you do because of it? Jean looks like a merchant's son, like a well-fed noble, like a plump little scholar. His appearance could be as much an asset to him as yours is to you.
I guess.
And if you needed any further demonstration that he can do things you cannot, well, why don't I instruct him to wallop the shit out of you one more time?
Locke attempted to spontaneously shrink down inside his tunic and vanish into thin air. Failing, he hung his head.
I'm sorry, said Jean. I hope I didn't hurt you badly.
You don't need to be sorry, Locke mumbled. I suppose I really did deserve it.
The threat of an empty stomach soon rekindles wisdom.
Chains smirked.
Hardships are arbitrary, Locke. You never know which particular quality in yourself or a fellow is going to get you past them. For example, raise your hands if your surname happens to be Sansa.
Carlo and Galdo did so, a bit hesitantly.
Anyone with the surname Sansa, said Chains, may join our new brother Jean Tannen in dining this evening.
I love being used as an example, said Galdo.
Anyone with the surname Lamora, said Chains, may eat, but first he will serve forth all the courses and attend on Jean Tannen.
So Locke scuttled about, embarrassment and relief mingled on his face. The meal was roasted capons stuffed with garlic and onions, with grapes and figs scalded in a hot wine sauce on the side. Father Chains poured all of his usual prayer toasts, dedicating the last to Jean Tannen, who lost one family but came to another soon enough. At that, Jean's eyes watered, and the boy lost whatever good cheer the food had brought to him. Noticing this, Carlo and Galdo took action to salvage his mood.
That was really good, what you did with the box, said Carlo. None of us can work it that fast, said Galdo. And we're good with sums. Or at least, said Galdo, we thought we were until we met you.
It was nothing, said Jean. I can be even faster. I meant to say...
He looked nervously at Father Chains before continuing.
I need optics, reading optics for things up close. I can't see right without them. I could work a box even faster if I had them, but I lost mine. One of the boys in Shades Hill...
You shall have new ones, said Chains, tomorrow or the next day. Don't wear them in public. It might contravene our air of poverty, but you can certainly wear them in here.
You couldn't even see straight, asked Locke, when you beat me. I could see a little bit, said Jean. It's all sort of blurry. That's why I was leaning back so far.
A mathematical terror, mused Father Chains, and a capable little brawler.
What an interesting combination the benefactor has given the gentleman bastards in young Master Tannen. And he is a gentleman bastard, isn't he, Locke?
Yes, said Locke. I suppose he is.
4. The next night was clear and dry. All the moons were up, shining like sovereigns in the blackness with the stars for their court. Jean Tannen sat beneath one parapet wall on the temple roof, a book held out before him at arm's length. 2 oil lamps in glass boxes sat beside him, outlining him in warm yellow light.
I don't mean to bother you,
said Locke, and Jean looked up, startled.
Gods, you're quiet.
Not all the time. Locke stepped to within a few feet of the larger boy.
I can be very loud when I'm being stupid. Can I sit?
Jean nodded, and Locke plopped down beside him. He folded his legs and wrapped his arm around his knees.
I am sorry, said Locke. I guess I really can be a shit sometimes. I'm sorry too. I didn't mean, when I hit you, it just... I'm not myself when I'm angry. You did right. I didn't know about your mother and your father. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have presumed. I've had a long time to get used to it, you know.
The 2 boys said nothing for a few moments after that. Jean closed his book and stared up at the sky.
You know, I might not even be one after all, Locke said. A real orphan, I mean.
How so?
Well, my mother's dead. I saw that. I know that. But my father, he went away when I was very little. I don't remember him. Never knew him.
I'm sorry, said Jean.
We're both sorry a lot, aren't we? I think he might have been a sailor or something. Maybe a mercenary, you know? Mother never wanted to talk about him. I don't know. I could be wrong.
My father was a good man, said Jean. They both had a shop in North Corner. They shipped leathers and silks and some gems. All over the Iron Sea, some trips inland. I helped them. Not shipping, of course, but record keeping, counting. And I took care of the cats. We had 9. Mama used to say, she used to say that I was her only child who didn't go about on all fours.
He sniffled a bit and wiped his eyes.
I seem to have used up all my tears, he said. I don't know what to feel about all this anymore. My parents taught me to be honest, that the laws and the gods abhor thieving. But now I find out thieving has its very own god, and I can either starve on the street or be comfortable here.
It's not so bad, said Locke. I've never done anything else as long as I can remember.
Thieving is an honest trade when you look at it like we do. We can work really hard at it sometimes.
Locke reached inside his tunic and brought out a soft cloth bag.
Here, he said, handing it over to Jean. What's this? You said you needed optics.
Locke smiled.
There's a lens grinder over in the Videnza who's older than the gods. He doesn't watch his shop window like he ought to. I lifted some pairs for you.
Jean shook the bag open and found himself looking down at 3 pairs of optics. There were 2 circular sets of lenses in gilt wire frames and a square set with silver rims.
Thank you, Locke.
He held each pair up to his eyes and squinted through them in turn, frowning slightly.
I don't quite know. I'm not ungrateful, not at all, but none of these will work.
He pointed at his eyes and smiled sheepishly.
Lenses need to be made for the wearer's problem. There's some for people who can't see long ways, and I think that's what these pairs are for. But I'm what they call close blind, not far blind.
Oh, damn. Locke scratched the back of his neck and smiled sheepishly.
I don't wear them. I didn't know. I really am an idiot.
Not at all. I can keep the rims and do something with them, maybe. Rims break. I can just set proper lenses in them. There'll be spares. Thank you again.
The boys sat in silence for a short while after that.
But this time it was a companionable silence. Jean leaned back against the wall and closed his eyes. Locke stared up at the moons, straining to see the little blue and green specks Chains had once told him were the forests of the gods. Eventually, Jean cleared his throat.
So you're really good at stealing things?
I have to be good at something. It's not fighting, and it's not mathematics, I guess.
Father Chains told me about this thing you can do if you pray to the benefactor. He called it a death offering. Do you know about that?
Oh, said Locke. I know all about it. Truth of all 13 gods, cross my heart and pray to die.
I'd like to do that for my mother and my father, but I've never stolen anything. Can you maybe help me?
Teach you how to steal so you can do a proper offering?
Yes, Jean sighed. I guess if this is where the gods have put me, I should bend to local custom.
Can you teach me how to use a numbers box so I look less like a half-wit next time?
I think so, said Jean.
Then it's settled. Locke jumped back up to his feet and spread his hands wide. Tomorrow, Carlo and Galdo can plant their arses on the temple steps. You and I will go out and plunder.
That sounds dangerous, said Jean.
For anyone else, maybe. For gentlemen bastards, well, it's just what we do.
We?
We.